Hello. It is February 16th, 2017. I just checked. And this is Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, James Jones. And with me today is Mr. John Lindemann.
Oh, well, hi, James. It's fantastic to be here.
It's fantastic to be here. Please, John, please, do not lie to me. Is it really fantastic to be here?
It is. I say that from the bottom of my heart.
I don't know how to respond to that. Hello, Guillaume Vayette.
Hey, hello.
Hello.
I didn't see you there.
Oh, why hello. How are you today?
I'm pretty good. I don't know. It's fine. We've had the snow for the past pretty much the entire week, so that's going to be fun.
Cool. So you're going to stay home, and yeah. you're gonna wait for the polar bears to come back down. You're good, right?
Yeah.
Are you fantastique?
Ça va bien.
All right, we're not doing this. That's enough culture for one episode of Radio Free Nintendo. Mr. Greg Leahy, hello. Please do not provide
everyone.
Any culture.
Fancy meeting you here.
Yeah. You come here often?
Oh, God.
Oh, what are we doing?
This is the pent-up sexual tension from all these years coming out right now.
This is a podcast where we talk about video games, allegedly. This is the 510th time we've done it. I don't know why, but here we are. Yeah. But this week, we were talking.
This is a Chained Heat podcast.
There you go. Yes, exactly. Mm. We were going to do. We went through during planning, and we decided that new business is a little bit light this week, so we were just going to do a double dose of listener mail. This is not a thunder round because I don't trust us to actually accomplish a thunder round. I have no recent evidence to indicate we remain capable of such things, so we're just going to do email for a while. As a reminder, we are 2 weeks away from the most important Nintendo event there is, our retroactive on Princess Tomato and the Salad Kingdom. There may be some other thing going on, so get playing it. But emails. You can send us your questions to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and we will read them on the show, potentially. Like this one right here, John Lindemann.
Oh, James Jones. Let me open this guy up. All right. Dear RFN High Lords, Heart Peace in Idaho writes, is The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wind the most monetized game produced by Nintendo? Look at the price for all related products for this game. Breath of the Wild Master Edition, $130. The Twilight Princess HD Retail, $60. Gotta have that 20 Heart Wolf Link amiibo. The Zelda series, amiibo, $50. Breath of the Wild series amiibo, $84, and the expansion pass for $20. Rounding up to include some taxes, the overall cost for this game is $350. Would it be better to have the game cost $350 and come with everything listed in one package? Granted, the game is only $60 and everything else is just optional. I guess the difference is similar to flying Southwest Airlines compared to Spirit Airlines.
So, first off, he didn't include the cost of having a place to play it. So you got to include your rent, which at a minimum.
what price do we put on your time for doing that extra Wolf Link thing to get it up to the?
That's
20
true.
Hours?
I mean, let's
your
say,
mortgage, today's interest rates. You know,
let's say you're talking at least $7 an hour, which is obviously very low. That's at least 40 hours of Twilight Princess. So you're running that price up. You know, you need to buy a house. You need a TV. You need a Switch.
Penny Arcade made that joke years ago.
You need the TV. It's kind of amazing.
You need the TV more than you need the amiibo. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that they might not even let you buy the Breath of the Wind, Breath of the Wild Master Edition.
We just had a conversation about this.
if you don't already have like a Wolf Link amiibo, like 20 hearts, like at the ready. So
like at the register, they ask you to present it, like you're buying alcohol.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you don't have one, you're clearly not one of the chosen ones. And so,
sir, I'm going to scan your Wolf Link. What I would love is if they just made one giant amiibo bundle. I know amiibo are slacking off in sales.
Amiibo, like a 6-foot amiibo.
Yeah, like a full size Link amiibo.
Oh God! So what are our thoughts on the pass?
It's a real doll, but it's an amiibo. Yeah, there you go.
That was a surprise to me that they would. I mean, because this franchise has kind of been a sacred cow, and that I feel like they sort of slaughtered it a little bit by adding DLC to it. But
damn, you just went right after it. You're not opposed to the slaughtering of sacred cows.
I'm not opposed
to it. That's okay. Fuck those cows. So. What to me, the season pass thing is what's a little worrying. You know, one of the things that somebody sent an email where I litigated the case against DLC, like from, I don't know, it was like 140, where I basically said something.
It was later than that. I mean, it seems in the 180s, I believe.
Okay,
Marion must die. Yeah,
yeah, but I had some harsh words for DLC. But I left it open to being like, hey, DLC that's built after the game is complete, well, that's a little bit different. That is apparently what at least some of this is, because they can't tell us what's in it.
Yeah, I think this is the interesting part about this. Clearly, this is somewhat modeled on what they did with Mario Kart 8 on Wii U. So the idea is, oh, you can buy it all, you know, up front, even though there's not really, you know, the meat of it is not going to be available for months. I think it was the summer is going to be the first sort of round, and then the most substantial stuff comes in the winter with the new story content and a new dungeon, all that kind of thing. But you get a bonus if you give them your money now, and then they get to keep it and earn interest on it or whatever.
Yeah, interest-free loan to
You get like the Switch t-shirt and quote-unquote useful items. does that mean they're acknowledging that the Switch t-shirt is not useful?
Not if you're playing it on Wii U.
It's aspirational in that case. But no, I mean, it's modelled on that, because pretty simply you had the sort of multicoloured Yoshi and Shy Guy thing as the bonuses in the case of Mario Kart, and then you had one pack of extra cups. At one stage, and then months later you had the second pack. The difference is that with Mario Kart, the games, we've been so sort of conditioned from the DS game onwards as to what constitutes a quote-unquote full Mario Kart game. And with the exception of the battle mode being barely there, Mario Kart 8 delivered a full Mario Kart game. You had your standard four sets of cups that were completely new tracks, four cups that were retro tracks. That's it. That's a Mario Kart game. It's been that way for 10 years now, more than 10 years. So it's so easy to quantify. It's like, okay, well, then we're going to get these, two pairs of cups on top of that. That's extra. I mean, it's very easy to quantify that. And I think people... kind of felt like that was something they could rely on to be, something they'd be interested in if they already like Mario Kart 8. This is a lot more sort of difficult to pin down what the hell you would be paying for.
Yeah, and also it's harder to communicate the value in this. Like the format of a Mario Kart game lends itself to DLC because, it's very obvious. You just add some more cups, more carts.
A track is a track.
Yeah, I mean, maybe add some more characters. Yeah. So
and also,
I'd
say they did a good thing of kind of making it feel more extra from the point of view. It's like, okay, now we'll do Link, we'll do F-Zero courses.
Right.
It feel like, well, yeah, this is stuff like that wouldn't be in a regular. Not only is it more Mario Kart, it's kind of going a little bit beyond the bounds of Mario Kart. So it kind of made it feel more, like worth paying extra for, I think. Whereas, you don't have that kind of very sort of tangible stuff to hang your hat on here with this. It's just kind of vague promises at this point.
There is we don't know how long dungeons are in this game.
The only things we've kind of heard is that there's like four major dungeons, isn't it? And then dozens and dozens of these minor shrines. So, is it a major dungeon that you know could be like, you know, 25% of the game's sort of big time dungeon content. Now that sounds substantial, but
what if those are just normal dungeon size?
They specifically said was a Cave of Trials, which kind of brings to mind the one in the Twilight Princess.
Well, that was separate. That was that.
Yeah,
that,
there's a dungeon and a cave.
The cave is in the summer, the minor summer kind of update, and then the full dungeon is in the winter update. Definitely. I mean, yeah, as soon as you say Cave of Trials, I think we all know that's what that bloody Twilight Princess wolf dungeon thing was, basically. You know?
Right. I guess I didn't really learn. I didn't really read the small type.
Yeah, well, like I said, it's not the messaging on it right now is, yeah, there is a certain amount there that, you know, if you read closely, you get some idea, but it is vague. It's not nearly as tangible as Mario Kart 8 was. And so I don't know whether Nintendo felt like, oh, well, that formula worked, we're going to just apply it again, but I don't think it's as easy as all that.
Right.
You know, it doesn't mean that this won't turn out sort of well in the end. You know, maybe right. This extra content will be really cool. Maybe we'll all play Breath of the Wild and think, yeah, you know, it's such a cool world. I'd just love more stuff to do in it rather than, you know, like major console Zelda games come along every 5 or 6 years. You know,
yeah.
You know, like that's not a bad thing at all necessarily. But, you know, because again, it kind of goes back to what talked about with the online stuff that, you know, where they've left room for ambiguity, people are invariably going to read bad things into that because of their track record and stuff. Like, that's the thing. Because Mario Kart 8, it wasn't much ambiguity there. You know, it felt pretty sort of solid what you were going to be getting. Whereas with this, there is that ambiguity, and people will, even though Nintendo have got a better track record, I'd say, with how they've done DLC than how they've done their online services, that's still more than enough for people to read the worst into and say, have they just kind of, you know, is the game still not entirely finished, and they're just kind of charging us for stuff that, you know, they didn't have time to finish in time for the Switch launch, you have time for the end of the fiscal year, which everything points to this being a pretty damn serious cramming before, you know, that hard deadline. So you can understand people feeling that way. There's all sorts of kind of suspicions that one can have, but that may all turn out to be kind of by the by when the content actually gets here. But yeah, to James' point about the thing with Mario Kart, a lot of people probably did just buy both, you know, the whole thing early and get their little bonuses and were happy. With this, it's the question is, will you at some point in the future be able to kind of buy the individual kind of packs, or, you know, because there's certain, like, Cave of Trials and Hard Mode and some of this stuff, you know, I can imagine people would rather say, can I not pay for that and just pay right. for the new dungeon that actually sounds substantial?
With story segment or whatever they say.
Yeah,
it's
original story. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, so yeah. New cutscenes, presumably.
Yeah, and yeah, with that, I wonder how impactful that story is going to be, because presumably by that time you will have beat the game. It's not like they're going to hold off the ending to the
right.
game say, "Well, here's the ending now."
You're not going to pull an Azura's Wrath, Capcom?
Capcom is always the role model you should use. Always
on the cutting edge of denying you the ending of game without paying for it.
Well, thankfully, like, we can wait. We have the option to wait. Like, they're going to sell this before the game's even out, I think. The kind of, you can pre-order the DLC, but one is obligated to, like, there's no advantage to pre-ordering.
No.
So
I mean, the advantage for paying.
I'm telling you right now, like, don't do it.
No, the only advantage for doing it, you know, before the summer is the t-shirt and the three chests in the Great Plateau or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Which is, it's presumably scant advantage. But yeah, so I mean,
right.
Realistically, it seems like you could at least wait until the summer and start to see, you know, people could give impressions and all that kind of stuff. But I understand the point about just wanting the two packs to be separate. Because like I said, I mean, it seems like the appeal of the later pack is quite a lot greater than the summer one.
The first pack seems quite like, oh, we could probably make this in time for summer. I generally don't like season passes, especially when you just don't know what's in them.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of a it's pretty anti-consumer, because ultimately you're asking us to give you money based on what essentially comes down to, no, we're good for it. Trust us. And granted, you can make the same argument about pre-orders. It's like, oh no, you should pre-order this game. Trust us, we're good for it. But pre-ordering exclusively digital content always kind of rankles me a little bit. I mean, into that end, I didn't, even though I knew what was in the Mario Kart one and thought, yeah, I'd like that stuff, I didn't actually pre-order any of it. I didn't, because remember, you could, because they wanted to get that bump right before the end of the fiscal year.
yep.
Because they announced they started selling that right before the fiscal year ended, so they could get money right now for literally nothing.
And that is in play here as well. So like you said, you can understand what, even though I think the Mario Kart example was, you know, better for them in terms of the messaging and the, you know, how it related with the fans.
It still
sets a precedent that people are going to look at this and say, okay, well, they're trying the same trick twice, except it's less transparent.
I think the only reason you should do Season Pass is if you're able to say explicitly, this is what is in it, here is a look in detail, this is why you will want it. Not the whole, like, I look at other open world games, and Bethesda's Season Passes are kind of notorious for this, where it's just like, there's going to be six packages and there'll be content in all of them and give us $60 please. Like that bullshit's terrible, and I think it's bad for the industry when you do stuff like that. I think you're putting your consumers in a position where they are potentially going to feel like they're being ripped off, and I just don't see how that is a healthy long-term thing for building a relationship with your consumers. I get that games are more expensive now and DLC is a mechanism by which they can come back some of the costs without having to raise the actual retail price of these games. I also understand that there are concerns about the secondary market and concerns about the falling value of games in the primary market, the initial sale. And DLC is a way to either get people who bought the game secondhand to pay you a little bit of money, or to get people who bought the game firsthand, i.e. not used, to hold on to the game and not put it into the market, or to get some money for people who got it on sale for like $20 a day after it came out. So there is, I understand the motivation for DLC, and I don't necessarily have the same sort of virulent reaction to it that I had on that episode. But I do think if you're day one launching with stuff, that can always look a little bad. But I think if you're trying to day one sell me stuff and you can't tell me what it is, that's worse. So
I don't know if it really damages like the perception that people have, like they feel ripped off or anything. Like you can't feel ripped off if you're not buying the thing, you know? Like
no,
I don't know. Like you could
see
it the other way. Like look at all this money I'm saving by just getting a freaking copy of the game and not caring about all this shit.
Look at all this money I'm saving by not buying $300 worth of amiibos.
A lot of, you know, like in the gaming industry, there's a lot of talk about like, oh, this is anti-consumer. Well, okay, don't be a consumer then. Just, you know, take that $20 instead of getting a Wolf Link amiibo, put in your 401k or something. Like,
I think that people can feel aggrieved about all sorts of things. I think that is certainly true. But I think people can feel ripped off from the point of view that if you believe, and this might be, you know, without basis, but you might believe, especially some of those things in that the summer pack, the more minor stuff like a Cave of Trials,
that
might actually just have been sliced off the game as it was in an attempt to sort of shore this thing up, and you know, this fiscal year business, it's almost just an exercise in intertemporal substitution. Just like, we've just got to have a cash grab now to shore up our revenue before this fiscal year closes out.
Because
from the messaging point of view, I think in many respects it would probably be better to talk about this afterwards, you know, the after a lot of people have played the game, and presumably they would believe at that point have been satisfied with it, I can have more, that's great. But there's one reason why it isn't that way, and that's because they want to start getting the money in before the end of the fiscal year.
Yeah, it's right. A shell game. Because this money is still going to come in regardless. Yeah. This is a shell game to move it up.
Like I said, yeah, intertemporal substitution, that's what it is. And so, you know, if that is so clearly part of the intentions, you know, it's got nothing to do with so much with, like, you know, the nature of the content or the nature of the experience or whatever, then, you know, that kind of base motive, I think, is understandable if people then feel like they might be, it's possible that somewhere in all this, they're getting shortchanged out of a cave of shadow, you know, a cave of ordeals type of thing. Maybe they like that in Wind Waker or Twilight Princess or whatever, and now they would have to pay for it separately, and they have to wait till the summer to do it or whatever. Like, that, it's possible. I don't think it's illegitimate to feel that way.
It could also be content that would have wound up on the cutting room floor as well.
That's also possible.
Sure. Yeah, but a Cave of Trials isn't usually content that gets on the cutting room floor. I think using terminology like a hard mode, like, that was stupid.
Like,
you
need to be, I think, as well, like, the message there is kind of, because, I mean, a lot of the time, hero modes and stuff in Zelda games, as the hard mode has been called quite a few times in recent years, it just tends to be a damage hell thing. There's not a lot to it. Now, you know, maybe given that this will be part of a DLC package that's cost money, people are going to pay for it, this will be a more substantively different hard mode, which would be interesting. But of course, there's nothing, you know, to indicate that to us at this stage. So again, that's the problem with this ambiguity that's in this at this stage.
But like, the game is not even, you don't even require a hard mode to make it harder on yourself. Like, I've seen some people on Twitter, like, people were kind of kidding, but, like, you know, like, they were already planning their naked vegan run. And I'm just like, oh, that's awesome, you know? Like, it's funny. And also, you're making the game harder for yourself, and, like, you're I don't know, like, you're not paying extra for it. Like, you're playing the game your way, I think.
But what if you want to do naked vegan hard mode?
That's
the name of my prog rock band, by the way.
It's such an open game, you know, that's such a big part of what they've touted about it, that you could, you know, everyone's going to have a different experiences, you could kind of go to the end, well, there's a lot of flexibility about going to the end, let's just say that, you know, all that kind of stuff. Like, it's how much of this stuff is really going to seem that valuable is questionable at this point. But
the only thing I would say, I'll let everybody go around one more time just so we can move on, is the idea that here's this content and we're not going to describe it at all, and we're going to use terminology that's just standard Zelda fare, especially for the summer stuff, I think is one of the most brain dead things of messaging that you could possibly do. And the only justification I could think of for doing the DLC announcement now is you're trying to ride it on the hype of the game. A legitimate justification, not just that we want to make our...
Not just an accounting justification.
Right. But it's a fucking Zelda DLC, was going to get coverage anyway, so that excuse more or less just falls completely by the wayside. But so if the entire purpose is just to appease an accountant, like... How the fuck did they screw up the messaging so bad? Like, legitimately.
Well, again, I feel like there may be an issue of this all be doing hastily. You know, I mean, a lot of things about this launch seem hasty. You know, hastily convened. The amount of, speaking of messaging, the amount of things that still, you know, by the time this episode goes out, it'll be less than 2 weeks away from the system coming out, and you're more likely to see stuff about the UI of the console from somebody that's got one early and leaking stuff online than you are from Nintendo themselves. I mean, there's a lot of things about this.
That is exactly what has happened
I feel like this. You know, we had said, where did predictions last year, remember that?
what are predictions? We don't do those.
Yeah, you know, the bottom line, I said I didn't know whether it would come, you know, in Christmas 2016 or when it is coming out, but hell or high water, they had to come out before the end of this fiscal year, and that's very much what it looks like. It's like, yeah, you know, ideally we wouldn't, but damn well we have to. So all of this is kind of getting crammed in very, very fast. And some mistakes, some oversights and sloppiness is going to happen in that scenario that wouldn't happen if the timeline were more sort of unconstrained.
Yeah, like I think that their messaging could have been better. Then again, like the preview video has like 2/3 of people giving it the thumbs up on YouTube, like the not the preview, but the announcement video. So I think you know, like the more negative voices are the loudest as usual. But there's a lot of people who are just excited to be like, oh, wow, okay. Like they're planning even more content for this thing, and I'm looking forward to it.
Well, like I said, again, I mean, you gotta look at the fact that these huge Zelda games are such a big event. You know, they come along so infrequently, and you know, the idea that, yeah, you know, you could play this and really love it, you know, like any big Zelda game you played before, or maybe in a different way, but then, you know, so many months later, come back and get more of that. That's not something you've had before. That's kind of exciting. I mean, for me, there's a similarity in some ways with Smash. Smash is a game that only has historically only come round really, really long cycles since Melee. You know, you went, what was it, 7 years from Melee, or 6.5 from Melee to Brawl, and then 5 to 6 years again from Brawl to the most recent one. You know, and then so the idea that you can have DLC, and it's like, okay, well, yeah, you have the game, it comes out, there's all these new characters and stages, but then the character and stages kept going for a while after that. That's great to me. The idea that like the party, because that's the thing. You wait for something this long, it's really exciting, it's great and all that. But then there's the inevitable. When it's over, it's like, oh god, it's over. You know, like there's another start the 5 year clock again. So the idea that you can forestall that and actually get more stuff is yeah, I think that's worth celebrating if it's done right. You know, it could be really cool.
If Nintendo can't tell us what's in it, then I can, you know, not give Nintendo my money. Like that's just
until you do know what's in it. That's the thing. I mean, that no one's forcing you to you know to do that. So I mean, on the one hand, I think we could say that, you know, it seems pretty you know, there's a bit of exploitation going on.
That's the one issue I have with it, is like the multiple ways that they have of trying to pick at your wallet. Like,
yeah, well, it probably I think discrimination. That
they could have probably announced the DLC with the Master Edition, maybe. You know, like, okay, like you buy this Master Edition, you're paying $130, you think, okay, I'm getting the complete deal, and then you're not. You know, like that's kind of a shitty thing to do. And then multiple amiibos, and, you know, they probably. I would encourage
$300, Guillaume. $350.
I don't know. I would encourage people not to get like a stupid like garden statue and stuff, because it's not gonna give you $30 more value like in your game.
I would just say most of the time with the amiibo, to be fair, they are. I mean, well, it's kind of a double-edged sword, but they generally don't tend to have that consequential functionality. So it's not like they're kind of blocking off, you know, a major part of the game behind a figure. A paywall embodied in a figure. But I suppose the wolf thing is kind of does seem more substantial than a lot of them have been, having this companion that you could summon into the game. With no indication where any of the others have anything similarly substantial, or whether it's just going to be like some of the other stuff we've heard about, where it's like, oh, some chests of fish fall from the sky.
We really need to move on, but
sure.
John, can you read the PS on this one, since we talked about Smash?
PS, of course the answer is no. Super Smash Bros. 4 is the most monetized game from Nintendo. $650 in amiibo alone.
There we go.
And also,
and
I will
the
say,
DLC, and my, then the other version, if you have
two
the,
versions
you
know. With distinct content, obviously.
Oh no,
two.
no! The app for the 3DS, so you can use it as a controller on the Wii U, that costs money.
The GameCube adapter. Don't forget the GameCube adapter.
That's true. And the four GameCube controllers.
My closing thought on Breath of the Wild is, it's Link's world. We're all just living in it, and shut up and take my money.
Great. Awesome. Guillaume, read the next email so we can escape this mess that we just created.
Jester writes, "You asked for emails, so here goes. What's your favorite Nintendo console? Mine is the Game Boy Micro. As far as I'm concerned, the Game Boy Advance had the best library, seeing as how it had incredible games and could play Game Boy games. Also, let's not forget that most of the best Super Nintendo and NES games were ported to it. The Micro is just incredible for its snazzy metal enclosure, backlit screen, and rechargeable battery. So yeah, I'm sure you all have discussed it before, but what is your personal favorite console and why? Keep on keeping it classy.
We already ruined that. He's writing from the alternate dimension.
One thing that's funny about GBA, though, actually, is that there's not quite the sort of perfect GBA. The Micro is nice. I have one.
Yeah, I love it.
I had a Famicom anniversary one. Because at one point they were flogging those off really quite cheaply.
Mm-hmm.
When in the height of the DS, and now it would be a lot more expensive to get one. But the problem with that is it does not play Game Boy games, for instance. Right. So that kind of limits part of the library that you do have on other versions of the GBA. But then, you know, the SP, for instance, most of those were the front lit kind. So they didn't. Mm-hmm. There was very late in the game, after the DS came out, a fully backlit.
GBA SP Plus.
I think it's mostly known by the model number, the 101, as opposed to 001. It had a screen more akin to a DS Lite screen, which is also kind of more like what the Micro had. So that is, in many respects, like the best GBA. You've got a good, nice, bright screen. You've got a clamshell. I like the clamshell form factor myself on all of those. That's going to be kind of sad if that goes away, I feel like, from Nintendo stuff in the future. But it didn't have the headphone jack.
A result, like, I never wanted to buy the adapter. And as a result, like, I don't think I know most of the soundtracks of the Game Boy games that I've played.
Nice.
It's sad, isn't it? There's these drawbacks. You know, to all the different, you know, like, I quite like the original GBA is kind of fairly comfortable to hold, but of course the screen was just dire. Had a bunch of mods that, you know, at the time you had the Afterburner mod was pretty popular. These days you get people that will mod that kind of GBA with a fully backlit screen from later models to try and get that best of all worlds kind of thing. It's tricky just to pick my favorite GBA, let alone favorite everything. especially if you kind of focus in on the hardware point of view, rather than just like the library.
Personally, I would focus on the library, and I guess the GBA had too many ports of Super Nintendo and NES games.
Well, I guess the saddest part about the thing with the GBA is that, you know, that was kind of all well and good to some extent, but if it had had a longer life, which in some ways it was entitled to. But, you know, basically the PSP buggered it all up. I mean,
Nintendo got scared and was like, well, we got to release this unfinished prototype that we have here right now.
And yeah, so exactly. And that kind of really cut short what the GBA's full library could have been. I mean, it is a good one as it is.
Right.
But yeah,
they had several years to start working on an original Mario game, and instead, like, just year after year, just a new Super Mario remake, and they got lazier and lazier. I don't know. That's one of my issues with the Game Boy Advance. My favorite would be the DSi XL, actually. It was kind of cool to have finally kind of a bigger screen on a Nintendo handheld. And I actually really liked a lot of DSiWare, all the stuff that Q Games made and Skip that I've talked about just in the last podcast. There were several really good kind of cell phone-y games, but like they were really well done. They were really cool. Of course, like, you've got the entire DS library, which I think overall I enjoyed more than the GBA library. Ace Attorney was just kind of like this, was kind of mind-blowing to be playing these Japanese-made, point-and-click adventure games on a...
Oh, yeah, those are games for events.
Portable. And, yeah, like, they just, I don't know, like, so much personality and style. Like, there were so many great Japanese games on the DS, like the Trauma Center series, and I don't know. Like, it just, I think that the fact that the DS was so popular in Japan really led to us getting a lot of freaking good portable games, and I'm not sure if that's ever going to happen again.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's kind of a very much a moment in time that feels like it's going to be very difficult to revisit that, because it's pre, you know, before the tyranny of mobile games.
Yeah,
put it that way. But again, I would say with DS though, there's still that kind of, obviously, even though James stuck with it for years or whatever, the DS flat is not very nice in
it's
general.
Fine.
But you know, you've got that thing, because if DS Lite, you have the option to play GBA games, even though they will they'll stick out of the cart slot. So then you've got truly a formidable library of games that you could stick in that thing. But you don't have access to the DSiWare there as well. So there's still, and it isn't, you know, it doesn't have the big screen, if that's what you like about the XL. So it's a similar thing in terms of it's tough to, it's not quite that like one all encompassing option that has everything that was good about that generation.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I would say my heart says the original NES. Yes, my mind says the DS Lite, because the DS Lite.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yep, just for what Greg said. I mean, it had an so many amazing games for it. I mean, I was just going through its games last night. I mean, I have like something like 30 games for it or something. It's just crazy. All the really good games that I thought were good enough to buy for that thing. It was just like endless games for the DS Lite. And it just, I mean, feels great, looks great. I just think it was awesome.
Tastes great.
If you didn't have that many DS games, like for a while, like the DS Lite came out, but there still weren't that much. There wasn't that much software that was really worthwhile. But it was at that point the best way to play GBA games.
Yep.
You know, with the backlit screen. So I really enjoyed playing like Final Fantasy, you know, Advance on that screen. So yeah, it was a good thing, but then the DSi XL came out, and
it
stole my heart.
I'm taking this question a different way than you guys took it. I'm not as concerned with the games. I'm thinking just from the standpoint of like my favorite piece of Nintendo hardware.
Right.
And you know, I actually, and you can laugh all you want, strongly considered the Virtual Boy. Because it's so fucking weird and wonderful and silly and ridiculous.
I mean, I don't know how much I can appreciate this as you play it, because I haven't had the pleasure myself. But just the backstory about the tech in that thing, the way actually creates that stereoscopic imagery is kind of a wonderful thing, even though it's also
it's kind of a nightmare
disaster,
at the same time.
You know?
Yeah, it's a fascinating piece of hardware. And when you're using it, even now, like I used it probably last time I turned it on. I mean, I'm looking at it right now. Probably the last time I turned it on was about a year ago, and that was mostly just to make sure it still worked. But it's an experience just to use the thing. You know, games aside, like what that thing does, even in a world of having had a 3DS now for what, 5 or 6 years, which obviously generates 3D that's much more physically palatable to your eyes.
Yes.
And much more colorful and useful and playable. There's a depth to the 3D in this that the 3DS doesn't do, because it's sprite layering. But there's just something about the experience where, like, you've gone into this weird sensory deprivation tank of a game, especially if you're using headphones, and you're just all in. I didn't pick it because there's obviously issues with that hardware. Dramatic issues. On the same token, I thought about what was that thing called? The Pokemon Mini. Because that is an insane device that they created and made games for, and people forget about it. And I love to pull it out. And I was only going to mention it because I was going to remind you it exists.
Or even the e-reader as well.
The e-reader
with the cards, super cool.
But I actually went with the GameCube, and you know, I could make a compelling argument for the games being the reason I'm going with the GameCube, but that's not it. You know, I think the tech in Wii U is kind of amazing and will never be appreciated for what it actually is. But the GameCube is just this fucking crazy thing when you think about where it came from in the industry at that point. Think about what the PlayStation 2, the Xbox, looked like. They were black slabs. They were such like fucking Matrix. Well, the Xbox especially was like some fucking Matrix bullshit. It's like,
no, look, I think what the Xbox looks like is if the Xbox was actually an animal that the Harkonnens from Dune would have hunted it and used its skin as clothes.
Yeah, I mean, like, part of it, like the big green gemstone on it. Like, it's, why is this here? Well, because it's future. And then the GameCube comes out, and it's this compact, it's not a cube, which is ironic.
yes.
It's just
it gets more cubey with a Game Boy player.
Right, and I'm going to get to that. It's this compact rectangular prism. And it looks so different. Like the colors, the controller, the fucking handle. Like I have a weird charm for the system, and it's got problems. It's got so many problems. The dumb disc format made it impossible to make a lot of bigger games on it. The fact that
we certainly
play
ended up with like double disc games, didn't you?
Yeah,
or
you
heard
games
about
where
other
we
systems
just...
it was not double disc,
right? You know, it didn't have a DVD player, which at that point actually kind of mattered versus now where, like, if you tell me this thing plays DVDs, I don't want it. but there was a thing about that system. It had its own style. It's had its own energy that was like, okay, I'm all right with this. And yeah, I bought a black one because I was in middle school, or maybe I was just in high school.
You were extreme at that point, James.
I was just like, well, I don't want a purple one. God. But like, in retrospect, like the spice one, the fucking, even what they called the colors was such a Nintendo thing. They called it spice.
Yeah.
I mean, just call it orange. No, it's spice. And then you have these ports on the bottom that they, I would call them, you know, we've used this word before. I'd call them aspirational.
yes, exactly.
But the Game Boy Player is a dumb piece of hardware that had no reason to exist that I love.
I think, you know, a lot of that was kind of they were trying to prop up the GameCube by doing as much sort connectivity, complementarity with GBA, which was successful, as they possibly could. That's how you got there. But, you know, it's a nice way to experience both GBA games and, of course, by extension, the GBC games as well. Yeah, I mean, it's still a good way to do it.
You had the two modems. Remember, there are two models of modem for this thing. There's one that takes a telephone jack, and then there's one that takes a standard network port for high speed internet connections. So, man, there was a dial up modem for GameCube. I can't think of anything more aspirational than that. For the no games that would support it, because PSO required you have high-speed internet, if I recall correctly. There was the dumbass ASCII keyboard GameCube controller, which, if you've never seen that, just...
It's been chapter art before, I can assure you.
It has.
Wasn't there a Phantasy Star keyboard?
That's what it's for, yeah.
That was for...
ASCII Works is a company that made it.
Right, okay.
The GameCube is this weird period of just asinine Nintendo, and I love it. And I kind of miss it, because when the Wii came around, you know, they were like looking at Apple design language, and they were trying to be all sleek and appealing, and the Wii U kind of tries that, but ends up completely screwing it up with the gamepad looking like a device from like a 70s sci-fi TV show. But there's this weird, like, we are a toy maker, goddammit, design element to the GameCube. And there's ideas in the GameCube that are just stupid. Like the handle. Or the fact that, like, at one point they showed it with an official, like, pop-up screen you could put on top of it. As if you're going to just carry it around with you. Oh, wait, it needs a plug. It's like there was just bad ideas all over the board that just made it better. And I appreciate that. So, yeah, that's my choice.
Yeah, if I to actually pin down a choice, I think if I'm focusing hardware, I would sort of go one further on the GameCube and sort of the Panasonic Q, which I actually had, which was the model that Panasonic made, naturally enough, that had DVD playback.
Yes,
as it's like, you know, it's still sort of cuboid, but it's also like a sort of classic toaster look, but with a mirrored face and
looks like an 80s sci-fi prop.
Yeah, more 80s, I guess. And the controller ports had a kind of blue light up around them, which kind of reminds you of the Wii disc slot coming later. But that was indispensable for me at university, to have DVD stuff and GameCube stuff in the same thing, to play and watch a whole bunch of stuff.
Well, remember, it had that LCD screen, too, to tell you what you were playing on it.
Yeah, that's right. That was sort of a bit of charm.
And it required its own Game Boy player because it had feet.
Yeah, exactly. It had those little toaster feet. It had a different Game Boy player module for it.
By the way, I bet the Game Boy player is kind of expensive, even though when you go to Japan, there's like a million of them on the shelves. I can't imagine what the Panasonic Q Game Boy player runs for.
Yeah, that's a good point. Probably weren't many of them made with it. So, but that is a cool piece of hardware, and it was necessary for me. It did a lot of hard service for me over the years. But I think if I'm focusing more on software, the DS Lite, I think, has got a very strong case to be made. But I would also like to make the case for the new 3DS, because you can put DS games in that. And then, you've got DS and 3DS libraries, which are pretty damn strong.
Including the DSiWare.
Yeah, then you get the DSiWare, and then you get Virtual Console, and on top of that, although it's slim, but it's Super Nintendo Virtual Console, which I'm very fond of visually in the original resolution. It's definitely the sort of the nicest way I've seen of those games being reproduced. So that's a pretty strong case to me. You put together DS, 3DS, all that digital content, retro and original, DSiWare and eShop. That's pretty strong, it's kind of hard sometimes to line up different eras against each other, but I guess the big advantage that has is it spans so many eras at that point.
Cool. All right, Greg.
Okay, so Travis in Los Angeles writes, "Hey fellas, forgive me if I missed a poignant tirade, but there's been a surprise..." Is that even possible?
It's an oxymoron of the ages.
Has there been a surprising lack of attention paid to the Kootar series of games that plopped into the 3DS eShop a few months ago? Kootar has, quote, "incredible expressionless emotions that can't be distinguished by laughing or crying," end quote. What does that mean?
That's like listening to our podcast. That's our audience reaction right there.
Does anyone know what these are, or has anyone tried them out? Is it worth paying 99 cents for Kootar end credits? Keep up the good work.
So I do know what these are, simply as a merit of the fact that we get the press release for what's on Nintendo Directs every week. And that week, there was an entire block that just said, "Kootar series, noun. Kootar series, noun." And I got deeply upset to the point of, I need to know what is going on here. Because I'm just going to read it. I'm looking at it right now. Kootar, jump rope. Kootar, apple. Kootar, tube rider. Kootar, ski lift. Kootar, powder factory. Kootar, burger factory. Kootar quiz. Kootar magic ball. Kootar concert staff, and Kootar end credits.
Ooh.
Which is, what the fuck, why?
I was with you until concert staff.
I don't even know what that one means. I don't know what concert staff means.
I don't know either. Is that like ushering people to their seats at a concert, maybe?
No, what's Kootar end credits? Is it literally just a game? It's a credit for the other games?
What is a Kootar,
So they all have, and I'm not joking, they all have their own listing on the Nintendo website. And of course, the Kootar character is Japanese as all hell. It's like a single palette colored cat thing that's stands upright with just a black, just black lines for her face and eyes. And yeah, the actual what is Kutar, to answer your question, is his quote that is from the Nintendo page. Kutar is a character who has been who has an incredible expressionless emotions that can't be distinguished by laughing or crying. Kutar is not a dog, cat, or bear. Kutar is always Kutar, no matter where he is going or doing. But I did not butcher that. It actually says Kutar is always Kutar.
To be fair, that leaves a lot of mammals in play that it could be.
It could be an ocelot.
Yes, yes, it could be. Ocelot is a cat, though. So maybe
you're
that's
right.
Excluded.
No, you're right. Though being so expressionless, when Kutar wants to laugh, cry, love, or be angry, all feelings are still very ordinary.
How the hell is one of these Kutar poker player?
You know what? Kutar sexy poker, yes. No matter what
happens.
If he's
so damn inscrutable, he should be able to fucking rinse everybody for all their money.
Yep.
The emotions will not change. Even a desperate situation arrives, Kutar will just inflate his body and overcome. What a wonderful Yuruchara. I want to point out, this is on Nintendo.com, a English language website. The lovely and funny Kutar game series is everywhere! Exclamation point. Just finished the quest challenge with simple controls. This time, Kutar works at the powder factory. He must catch the powder from the tubes above very carefully. What the fuck did I just read?
Well, what about concert staff?
All right, well, so if you search for Kutar on the thing, you get a bunch of them. So let's look at concert staff. You get your standard what is Kutar, including English language being butchered.
Yep.
This time, Kutar joins the staff of a live audience. What?
And keeps audience has staff?
Why is live capitalized? And keeps pushing back the audience away from the lines. Why would you push them away from the lines? That's what they're... What? All right, I need to know, what is Kutar end credits? I mean, at this point... I wanted to just say, this time Kutar watches the people who made the other 9 Kutar games. This time, Kutar performs as the stuntman and challenges his limits. To raise your rating, you must ride through the explosives found on each road. How is that end credits?
Because stuntmen are only acknowledged in the end credits. Yeah, the rest of the time you're meant to think they don't exist. So, but yeah, it doesn't really sell the sort of high-octane nature of it, does it?
No. So I had that game Battle Cats that I talked about a while ago. And it's like this weird, surrealist nothing. Like it is sugary nothing laced with LSD. So that seems like what these are. Like they know that this is just nonsense. That these games are pointless. Do any games have a point? But like nihilism aside, that they know that. What is here is nothing, and so they've just gone full in. I will say that to give you an idea of how nothing this is, the ESRB logo for it is E no descriptors, which is amazing. I've never seen one where they explicitly say there are no special descriptors required for this review.
We literally could not describe this.
I would have loved it if the descriptors were laughing and crying.
But no, he inflates when he wants to laugh or cry.
That's the misleading.
What the fuck is this? I don't know. I Circle Entertainment brings over some of the weirdest goddamn shit, and like occasionally they'll have something really good. Sometimes they'll have stuff that's just garbage. Sometimes they'll have stuff that's Kutar, which. He's probably garbage, but also Kutar is Kutar, no matter where he is going or doing.
Yeah, Kutar got to Kutar. That's what that means.
No matter where he is going or doing, John.
Expressionlessly.
Where are you doing?
Expressionlessly.
Expressionlessly. Well, in body inflation.
I assume Kutar does Dallas is in the offing or something.
Kutar Vegas, I think, is also.
Kutar is not a dog, cat, or bear.
He runs the poker tables in Vegas.
I need to know.
If it's a he, I don't really think it's even
Kutar
gender.
It's Kutar.
Yeah, there's no gender Kutar specific. Kutar. Sorry, my bad, Kutar. Sorry.
This time, Kutar joins the tube riding match on a snowy field.
Yeah, I'm amazed you got past tube rider without more, like, something, comment, guffawing.
Yeah, because I mean,
you're such a big tube slider guy. I would have thought tube rider would have got
to be fair, I was hoping that it would just be like, just tube sliders with Kutar's face on it. ND Cube created tube sliders, to be clear. This time, Kutar will strike the baseball. You have to be cool and hit the magic balls in the row from the pitcher. What? Magic balls? They're baseballs. You said they were baseballs 5 words ago. But...
The ball's juice, James.
it's steroids. Okay. So Kutar is a biting commentary on our modern day world. So I think we killed Guillaume. Or perhaps he's downloading all the Kutar games right now.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. I want a full report on my desk by morning about Kutar Magic Ball. And if you need to do it, you are free to use some Kutar powder so you can keep going. maybe that's it. Kutar Powder Factory is the anabolic steroids. It's that compounding pharmacy. Was it San Diego?
Balco.
Yeah, it's Balco.
Yeah, it has the cream and the clear and then
Kutar Magic Ball.
Yeah,
is the users
the cream, the clear, and the Kutar.
This time, Kutar will ski! Exclamation point.
Oh man!
Before that, you have to take lifts in order. You have to take the lifts in the order, and sit down at the right time.
I like to take my lifts out of order. That's right.
How many lifts are you taking? What? God damn it. All right, that's the end of Kutar.
Thank God.
Kutar is Kutar, no matter where this email is coming or going. I think, actually, we're going to go ahead and take a break there, and when we come back, it'll be time for some more emails. So stay tuned for Kutar. And we're back, and it's time for more listener mail, now with 100% less Kutar.
We're now living in a Kutarcracy, by the way.
We're in a post-Kutar world?
Mm-hmm.
During the break, we found out there's like a lot of Kutar games, and there's also, in Japan, apparently a Kutar magazine with exclusive Kutar games, and I don't want to live anymore. So, I'm going to go ahead and read the next email, because that might kill us. Wesley writes, recently, Shinya Takahashi discussed how there could potentially be a 3DS successor down the road. Do you think it will be fully compatible with the Switch, or is this just PR speak for we will kill the 3DS if Switch is successful?
3DS is in a weird spot, kind of, because what I would say, I would agree with that if not for the new 3DS.
Really? What about new 3DS is your...
I don't know. It just seems weird to put that product out and kind of keep supporting it with, you know, Super NES games specifically that work only on that product. On the one hand, that is very Nintendo to me, but on the other hand, it's very weird to me to just kind of keep, I don't know.
I mean, in a way, though, that sort of mimics the DSi. But
yeah.
The DSi was forward compatible to the 3DS.
And the DSi wasn't brand new hardware. It had new hardware in it, but it wasn't more powerful.
It was actually more powerful. Yeah, I mean, there are some parallels, but you're right. It does feel a little bit different.
Well, I think the big thing for me, I mean, yeah, I think a lot of things are contingent on just on what happens with Switch, how well that does. But I don't think it's just it's not just like a linear, like, how successful is it? If it's successful above this threshold, then they'll kill off a 3DS or a separate line. And if it's under a certain threshold, then they might keep it going. It may also be about, you know, the particular demographics or, you know, patterns that emerge in the different markets. If it kind of reveals some kind of gap in the market that could be, you know, so Switch is still broadly successful, certainly more so than you know, the Wii U was, but you know, maybe they still feel there's a gap in the market that you could still see maybe something that could be served by a separate portable that could, you know, it be construed as a successor to the 3DS. But I mean, they have spent a fair amount of sort of effort on consolidation and all this kind of stuff to seemingly, you know, waste as little resources as possible on having, you know, like different platforms, different architectures, different things like that. So to the question of whether, you know, it would be compatible with Switch, whatever this thing, hypothetical thing could be, like, I mean, you might think it would at least be, you know, a very close cousin of it, even if they positioned it marketing wise as something more in a DS line, you know, just in terms of for development purposes.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, knowing what Switch is now versus when I did the whole big thing about it, are they going, is this real or not? I actually feel less capable of answering the questions I originally had. like I seem to know less now that I know more, which isn't a super unusual thing. Like if you're doing engineering, but you're trying to figure out what the fuck company's trying to do, that's kind of obnoxious. What I would say is that they're definitely, I would say almost certainly someone in Nintendo right now is doing R&D on a handheld device.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's kind of, it was mentioned with the DS, Guillaume was talking about the hastily that came out. You know, that could easily have been a prototype that never saw the light of day. But, right. You know, like, because they probably were, I'm sure we've heard about other cases in the past, you know, they're working on these sorts of things all the time. You know, I'm sure they're working, we've heard the talk about sort of the different sort of earlier versions of what the GBA ended up being that, you know, just didn't happen in terms of the market because Pokemon, you know, spurred such a huge kind of resurgence in the standard Game Boy platform and Game Boy Color that, you know, that kind of postponed it for. So again, a lot of this stuff is subject to market conditions, but yeah, they'll be working on stuff. They will have irons in the fire on that front because you've got to be prepared for these various contingencies that the, you know, the market performance of the Switch and everything else that's going on in the entertainment world might throw up.
Yeah. I mean, what could be useful though is if they are able to leverage some of the platform that they're building, the relationships that they've created with external parties to work on Switch hardware, and then parlay that into a portable device, and then at the very least, and John threw this out there a while ago when we had a similar conversation, that you won't have to train people on new shit every time they want to change platforms.
Exactly.
That it's the same technology. It's the same, if not the same power levels, the same, you know, but the same general concepts are all in play, and it's much easier to migrate between a project for one platform versus the other. But definitely, if the Switch comes out and just blows the doors off, I think you're going to find Nintendo is much more interested in just making a smaller Switch than they are in saying, let's make this other thing. Because
yeah, obviously it could be a branding kind of issue in terms of, you know, like maybe whether that product would be, you know, like a Switch Mini or would, something that
would it be
is
a Switch a Lite like, or a Lite Switch?
Yeah, or you know, on
Lite
the other
Switch,
hand,
there you go, done.
Very nice. Or whether you never know. They could do something like really left field if they wanted to keep a dedicated dedicated portable called Strand Alive, and like bring back Game Boy branding or something for some nostalgia play. You know, they've seen some good results with that sort of thing in the past. I wouldn't put it past them trying that again. But yeah, if the Switch becomes such a powerful brand unto itself, they might, you know, any such product might be, you know, just given that branding and then whatever modifier you want to attach to it. But like I said, I feel like it's gonna be, it's not just a question of how successful it is in broad terms. It's going to be how successful it is in the different places. You have Japan having sort of different dynamics to America and Europe and whatnot, but also with the different demographics. You know, I mean, how well will Switch actually do sort of with kids, and do they feel like there's a sort of a separate a place they could go to? You know, because I mean, they only just sort of started selling 2DS in Japan, you know, with this sort of really aggressively sort of cheap hardware, and you know, it's very kind of sturdy and difficult to break, and they've, you know, obviously the big Pokemon push that came last year and all that. You know, it kind of feels like they've rediscovered that vein after, you know, a generation where arguably the 3DS, you know, even after its price cuts and stuff, kind of maybe got them sundered from that youth market more than usual. Maybe they see that that's something, you know, with the success, especially the surge, and this goes back to what I was saying, you know, about the GBA kind of thing ended up coming later than it might have done because of Pokemon. I mean, it could almost be a similar thing here in terms of Pokemon leads them to say, well, hey, you know, we want a sort of discreet, low-cost device, whether it might be some kind of relative of the Switch family of systems or whatever, or, you know, wherever it's branded, just some kind of entry-level device that we can keep going to the very low-end youth market on.
Yeah, and, I mean, we don't know. We heard rumors of 2018 for, like, that's the EOL of 3DS. Sorry, end of life. But I don't know, like, we've heard so much shit related to the 3DS and Switch, that interplay, that at least to date has not panned out. I don't know how much credit we can put into it. But certainly they seem to at least have some irons in the fire on 3DS, and they're very eager to tell us about it.
Because I think the problem, you know, I mean, they just, for the first time in a while, they've actually had some good news, like some better than expected. You know, they've been overestimating their revenues in various streams for so long, you know, and then thanks to Pokemon in large part, you know, the 3DS goes and outperforms. You know, I'm sure they're eager as much as anyone to signal to the investors, like, no, we're not going to just kill it off now that it's kind of, you know, found its feet again. You know, so yeah, I feel like it's all contingent on, you know, on circumstances. There is no master plan here, I think, that's just waiting to unfold irrespective of what happens in the market. It's going to be a wait and see proposition.
Yeah, and at the very least, you would hope that the whole Switch process has taught them some stuff about hardware construction. And I do wonder what the selling point for a let's say Switch comes out and is a tepid success. You know, maybe they would want more, and they think there's meat on the bones for a portable device. How do you position it in a Switch inhabited world? How would you market it and say, like, oh man, you could, because part of Switch is the ability, its marketing is the ability to go game anywhere. It's in the marketing.
Yeah, but it's also like it's console quality gaming anywhere. That's kind of the thing there. So to try justify the price and all that, and what's novel about it, because you know we've had portable gaming for quite a while,
right?
So yeah, I think that, I mean, I don't want to go full Tim Robbins here, but it's, you know, for kids, like that would probably be a lot of it. Like, it would be, it's lower cost, it's, you're not gonna lose $50 because half of the controller gets lost on the train or the bus or whatever, that kind of thing.
And smaller, don't forget,
smaller. I mean, more portable, more exactly. Durable, yep. Better,
like,
battery,
actually pocket size.
Yeah, all these sorts of things. That would be the, you know, and I know what you mean. It's still kind of awkward, because what that does is kind of highlight the ways in which Switch is not that portable. Although, yes, you know, it may well get more portable, as we've said many times. You know, Nintendo always going to iterate on this kind of hardware. It will get better in various ways. You know, there's no doubt of that, I'm sure. Whatever the strategy ends up being, unless it's just such a disaster that it's not even worth pursuing. any further. But no, I think that seems to be the most obvious thing to me is if they feel there's room for that kind of device to hit that very specific niche that kind of, you know, that they're maybe finding some success with 3DS/2DS at the moment.
Yeah, and the other thing is, how does it live in the environment where they also have mobile games? Because honestly, that's what kids are playing games on right now. On their parents' device.
Well, that's going to be the other part of it in terms of waiting and see with you know, how things go with them, with market conditions. I mean, you know, like I said, right now there's still maybe some kind of niche for that kind of thing at the low end, but maybe, you know, 3 years' time, maybe, and with however well they're doing out of the mobile part of their business, they might just feel like it's not worth you know, the trouble of putting a specific device out to try and exploit that vein anymore, because it's not big enough and we're doing well at a mobile anyway, maybe.
And potentially they would have three devices all for, hey, you can play these on the go, and that's weird. Like, that's a weird place for them to be in, to have three distinct formats for playing when you're not at home. And I mean, you could say that it's almost like an automobile manufacturer at that point, where you've got like the Halo cars, you've got their Econo boxes, and then you have the thing that they sort of sell in the majority, their middle band. But they don't really have – that's not really what they're trying to do, because they want everyone to buy Switch. They want everyone to also do the mobile game stuff. And at some point, you're asking people for a lot of their time. Like, hey, I've got three devices you can play on the train.
Yeah.
Can you play all of them, please? And I don't know that people are going to
– Yeah, I you've got to think if it was going to happen, it would be aimed squarely – at people, you know, that wouldn't be buying a Switch. Like I say, you know, that they've got the data that suggests certain demographics in certain territories, whatever it would be. Like, these are people that, you know, maybe, you know, the mobile data suggests they know about our franchises. They might be interested in them, but there's something about Switch, the price, the form factor, whatever, that it doesn't fit into their lives. So if we our data suggests if we put a device out of this sort, we could hit them and it would be worth it. It's got to me, it would have to be that, you know, data driven. You're not going to know that until the things start to play out.
Yeah, but right now it's all PR talk. Like, we can agree on that, right?
Yeah,
absolutely.
it's not just PR. Yeah, you know, the public relations, but I do feel there's an element of investor relations as well with the things they say, in terms of, you know, they're trying to say to investors, like you know, we don't want to seem like crazy, like you're moving to kill this thing off for something, you know, in Switch, which we have no idea how successful it's going to be. You know, they don't want to seem like they're slamming the door on something just as it's having a nice little comeback.
Yeah, and you know, historically, that's always been kind of something they've done well. They've always had great handheld, you know, handhelds. So,
yeah.
To just go away from that cold turkey, I think that would probably freak a lot of investors out. No,
they haven't had a flop, you know, on that, unless you count Virtual Boy, which, yeah, Virtual Boy is, you know, not really.
3DS, though, may have
been... 3DS was troubled, but it's not, I mean, you know, with more than 60 million units sold worldwide, you know, you compare that to 13... For Wii U, 21 for GameCube.
Mm-hmm. It's got to at least make them a little nervous, though.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's the thing. They should not be.
The market is less hospitable now than it was in 3DS.
Way less. And presumably getting less and less hospitable. That's how you've got to project these things forward. You know? So, yeah, I agree. I don't think that this should be an automatic thing by any means. I think it should be very carefully considered based on what they observe.
Let's throw this out there. What if they I know they've released three, but we'll say the two mobile real games they've released, because Candy Drop or whatever the fuck they call it, a Mii Drop in Miitomo is not exactly the most gamified experience there is. They're very mobile games. And they're, you know, it is what it is. There are limitations on what you can do in the form factor. But and they're only talking about doing, what was it, four a year right now? which is down.
Well, I mean, don't forget, I mean, originally the plan for the past, you know, the fiscal year that's just coming to an end was to do 5. Right. Then it was to do 4, and then Animal Crossing got bumped out because it's like, oh, well, actually, we're doing kind of a second launch of Mario Run because, you know, the exclusivity to Apple. Yeah, so I mean, they're not delivering very well on this MoPod stuff so far.
It was then we're going to do 4, and then it was, oh, by that we meant next year. So, you know, maybe they get that pipeline going and they start finding ways to make better experiences than waiting for timers. I mean, I know, quote, that's what the mobile audience wants. My argument would be that's what the mobile audience has been fed.
The only way they've kind of pushed the boundaries of the mobile ecosystem as it exists currently is the whole $10 price of Mario Run. In terms of design, it doesn't seem like they have, but
not
they
really.
Could,
no,
hypothetically, I suppose.
Maybe they would feel that ameliorates the need for them to have a mobile device.
It's a separate like device aimed at kids or whatever else it would be. Yeah, exactly. Again, that's another thread of like you have to wait and see how well these things do before you move to put whatever prototypes they've got in development into actual production.
There is remarkable uncertainty here, isn't there?
Well, of course, hugely due to sort of dangerous time for Nintendo. I mean, there's opportunities there, but this is you know some really weird stuff.
I still see a hole in the market for a handheld strictly for children, like something that isn't a $200 subsidized $200 phone that you're going to hand to your kid.
But what would you make? So, all right, here's I'm gonna give you the best use case I could think of. All right, thing is digital only. There is no retail games for it available.
Yep.
Now that cuts down on your visibility to consumers. Like that's something we don't really talk about when we talk about digital versus physical. Is that having games on a shelf is good for brand awareness?
Mm-hmm. Presence.
Yeah. But maybe it does take cartridges. I think that would be a mistake for this device. Everything that it plays needs to be Switch compatible because it's hard for me to say Nintendo's going to cut off part of their development resources to make things for this low profit margin device. But if they were able to make a subset of games that are Switch compatible, that are also available for this thing, that are smaller, you know, in terms of the, you know, what the hardware demands are, then maybe you're in a place. Because if the games are digital only, then you don't have to worry about somebody buying a Switch game and going, why doesn't it work on this device? Because they can only buy them digitally.
Yeah.
And then, but the challenge is, are third parties going to, well, I guess they would. I mean, if their game would work on this thing versus the Switch, then they'd probably say, okay, well, I'll make it for this and I get it on the Switch for free. But you don't get those sweet, sweet license fees, but you get a cut of sale, so maybe. But at that point, really, isn't it just a shitty Switch? Like, pun or alliteration not intended?
Well, it depends on your point of view. If it's something that you buy for your kid that's less expensive and far less likely to break, or that they can play for a longer time because of the battery life or whatever, then it's better than a Switch for what you want to do with it. You know,
I'm just struggling with the, I get your point that, hey, I want to give my kids this thing that they can play games on. But right now, it seems largely like they just give them their phone, or they give them like
exactly, exactly,
or but, iPod you know, Touch.
It'd have to be real evidence that it was a sort of vein worth tapping, and that's not going to emerge. And for maybe a couple of years, I don't know. It depends how impatient they want to get. But the Switch is kind of the biggest component of it in terms of how well that does. But then the second component is their mobile games and mobile in general, how that proceeds.
Yeah, I mean, we bought my niece Kindle Fires. We bought a bunch of them. They're like the $99 Kindle Fires that are literally, they don't even bubble pack them anymore. They're just in a paper package. They hang from a hook at the store. Like they don't even care. They are dirt cheap, because of course Amazon sells them under cost because they expect you to buy Amazon software or Amazon products or Amazon services to pick up the cost. Not dissimilar from the console publishing thing, but like I could buy these for my nieces and just hand them to them, and now they've got access to all of the stuff on Android that they want. But maybe that's the path. Maybe you're right. Maybe it's something dirt cheap that also could play Android stuff, but then it's got to go online and it's got, I don't know. I don't have an answer.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not an engineering problem. Like there are many ways you could skin this cat mm-hmm. from an engineering standpoint. I think it's purely a market position standpoint. And
yep.
I don't know what the hell the market is right now. And that, I mean, I get that's kind of our job here is to have some kind of inkling or have be informed or at least be able to offer kind of informed opinion. But I don't know that if you were to sit down with Takahashi or even with like, you know, the board, if you put Nintendo's board in front of you and asked in Japanese, presumably, like where they think the market will be in 5 years, I don't know they'd have a good answer for you.
I mean, what do you have to go by? I mean, right now, the 3DS market is basically the handheld market.
Period.
That's the ceiling that you're looking at.
Right. But is that okay? Like, if they were to release another device, and given the fact that 3DS went through a bunch of iterations and there's definitely multi-cells on there, let's say the ceiling is 40 yeah. million units.
Yeah.
Would they accept that? Probably. I would hope so.
Yeah.
But how would they feel about putting resources in to develop software for it?
Yeah, that's a heck of a lot of R&D for 40, 50, 60 million maybe, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's but maybe not. Maybe it's just the guts of a fucking cell phone and they put buttons on it. Like, who knows?
Yeah.
It's hard to project out because it's an evolving marketplace. And mm-hmm. I don't know what the demands of consumers will be in 2022.
Yeah, it's very weird being in a world where it's tough to gauge the demand for Nintendo products. You know?
Because
it's just it feels very foreign to me.
In a way, the demand is super high. You know, we saw it with Pokemon. Like, there is a craving injected into my veins. Yeah. You know, they signed a huge deal to make theme parks.
Yeah, it's all in how they're packaged now. That's what it comes down to now.
They've got you know, media development deals in the fire. Mm-hmm. Like, in a way, demand for Nintendo properties is really high right now.
Yeah.
But it's hard to sort of put that in terminology of when you start talking about things on which I will play my video games. When you say, I'm not worried about the property right now. What is the device that I am going to be playing it on?
Yeah, the medium.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, if they released a cheap device that is like, oh, this plays a subset of the Switch's library, or rather the Switch plays its library, the marketing would never say it plays a subset of Switch's library. They would say, it plays games made for this thing, and then they'd market separately, hey, this game's also available on Switch, mm-hmm. just for messaging sake. I don't know that I would buy it. Like, and I would say, yeah, I get better battery life. Okay. You know, maybe it's another, like, I bought the new 3DS in large part because I was flying to Japan, and the 3DS, my old 3DS, my launch day 3DS, was old, and the battery was kind of shitty. And so the new 3DS had a new, fresh, happy battery, and it was on sale, and it was a new 3DS I wanted, the smaller one. But I would have very happily not bought that system. So I legitimately don't know, and I don't know that we can project any more than that. John.
Onto writes, here's someone emailing you about the GameCube Virtual Console. I really don't see a problem, actually. The analog triggers missing on the Switch is a pain in the bumper, but the four shoulder buttons as well as the plus minus buttons can substitute both analog and digital GC triggers. Hold ZR to make Mario stand still and shoot the flood. Hold R to make Mario be able to run around and shoot the flood. Problem solved.
Well, that doesn't solve the problem for the most important GameCube game that used its analog triggers. Automodelista. So we actually got a little bit. We've been begging for an email about this because this was one of those rumors that now, you know, maybe it's in jeopardy. We actually got some more clarity on this just the other day, which is we're working on stuff. We have nothing to announce at this time. And also, we could totally release Joy-Con attachments that have GameCube-style controls on them. But, quote, I think they would look bulky. End. So the question is, I guess, A, do you think they're actually doing something? I mean, I would assume they actually are experimenting on GameCube Virtual Console stuff. But would you buy a set of Joy-Cons? Let's say they cost less. Let's say they're $55, which only means anything to John and I. but let's say they're like 30% less than the standard Joy-Cons. Would you buy them knowing that really the only value is GameCube Virtual Console?
Well, it would depend also on how confident you are in the sort of robustness of the library of GameCube games they would have. You know, I mean, it's one thing if it's just like the really super obvious stuff, like Sunshine, maybe Luigi's Mansion, with Wave Race, all those kind of early titles, and then the big Melee, presume all that kind of stuff. But you know, I'd at least want some faith that it'd be reaching into the sort of avenues of game we've sort of touched on this topic before of GameCube that I didn't play at the time. Like, yeah, there'd be some games I'd be happy to buy again. It's portable or whatever. You know, that's cool. Yeah, I've done that with plenty of other generations of Nintendo hardware, but that element of it on its own, I don't know whether that would be enough to justify a purchase of. I guess it somewhat depends on how much cheaper they would be, because I mean, like you said, you could get rid of the HD Rumble, for instance. You know, you could cut down on the cost pretty significantly, I would have thought, but you'd have to see. I mean, the thing is, of course, a lot of the sort of appeal of the GameCube controller is bound up in Melee and Smash generally, but for people that wanted to, for instance, use GameCube controller on Wii U, you know, the other appeal of that adapter that came out is that it was wired, you know, so which you wouldn't have in this case. So
right.
The whole having the Joy-Con in a GameCube style, it could solve the analog trigger thing, but it wouldn't necessarily appeal to the Smash crowd. So,
no.
I mean, presumably you could, I mean, I don't know whether they'd bother like, having it be compatible, but the adapter that currently exists could be compatible because there's enough USBs on it to, because it needed two, didn't it? But there are enough USBs on the dock to make that work if they wanted to.
The ones that come to mind are obviously Sunshine, the Rogue games, and like the racing games in general, obviously. And we've talked about that on the show, that having analog triggers for racing games is kind of unfortunate, but I've managed. In general, racing games are actually do on our systems use the analog controls.
Yeah, because you had that thing with the Need for Speed Most Wanted U, didn't you? Like that had to kind of.
Yeah, and it was kind of okay, but there was definitely moments you thought, wow, I would love to be able to kind of not accelerate hard. Instead, you had to kind of throttle the accelerator. Just keep bouncing on it, which is kind of obnoxious. But I mean, for me, I could probably survive without it. Honestly, I could live without ever playing Mario Sunshine again.
Yeah,
I wonder whether Sunshine might actually be a better candidate for a remake of some sort. Yeah, something that's. I mean, you think about it, the Zelda games of this sort of vintage have all received substantial remakes. You know, the 3D remakes in the case of the N64 games, the HD remakes in the case of the GameCube games, which in addition to those the obvious visual changes that are in the titles, would clean a few things up here or there, and I feel like Sunshine could benefit from some of these. It was not Nintendo's most polished work. There's numerous sort of things that are a bit sort of janky, and I mean, they did put a little bit of extra content in Mario 64 DS when they did that, so I guess it's not impossible if they did a Sunshine remake that they could put some extra content in there as well, maybe cut down on the amount of blue cut, because it was just this sort of weird exercise in numerology, really. I mean, it's like, well, we have to get to 120 Otherwise, yeah, the sacred number has not been hit. So we've got this much. Okay, so now we're just going to have to put some blue coin associated ones to make up the numbers, you know. So maybe now they could actually, you know, get to that number not quite so crudely as they did before. So, and therefore, you know, if they were going to do a remake of it at some point, maybe they wouldn't be so quick to release it digitally. I don't know. But I think it would definitely benefit from it as much as anything. And then that would kind of sidestep the kind of issue of having to emulate the triggers, because they could actually kind of just change it. You know, they could change the gameplay however they wanted to fit the Switch hardware however they wanted to. But I guess the thing is, who would do that remake? You know, because I mean, you got the Mario Odyssey team is going to be busy with that, and you know, so it would be interesting. You know, they could have obviously farmed stuff out like that before to the Funky Barn people, Tantalus, or, yeah, with Twilight Princess HD. But yeah, you almost kind of feel like if it was going to happen, it maybe we would already know about it. Like, it's the kind of thing that would probably like come out in this summer, like as to hold you over for the big Mario, like the real Mario, whatever.
Yeah, but is that not almost too close? Like,
that, yeah, exactly. That's what I'd say. It would make more sense if Mario Odyssey was further out and it was like holding you over till a year from then, rather than, you know, to the whole. So I doubt it's happening. I just feel like it would be kind of apt for one.
As a counter, I almost wonder if we'd be better off getting and I know we've had one before, but getting a real actual remake of Mario 64.
Yeah, no, I mean, DS is a number of things that do get cleaned up in DS, but yeah. Obviously it kind of had the sacrifice true analog control, which was like one of the defining sort of features of
this
that game.
Was a tech demo of that feature.
So it's not exactly like the definitive version, even though there's a number of things that, I mean, for instance, obviously the graphics, you know, DS wasn't like way more powerful than the N64, but there's just these like character models that were just wrong in the 64 game have been corrected. Yeah, they actually look like Bowser does not look like giant baby Bowser anymore. He looks like Bowser. You know, so there's a lot of ways in which the DS version is better, but yeah, it's not unambiguously better by any means. So there's totally scope for 64 to get that kind of treatment. And I'm sure it's got a lot more kind of, you know, mind share and place in people's memories and hearts than Sunshine ever did. Even though, I mean, I enjoyed Sunshine at the time, but Mario 64 was a far more significant event.
Yeah, I mean, if they found that the nostalgia bomb, you know, that Pokemon Sun and Moon and Pokemon Go have proven for them, then that may be a better angle to take. You know, something like a Mario 64 remake, where they can say, hey, remember that game from 96 from your childhood, now adult with children? We remade it. And it's better than ever. And look, here it is. You can play it. But yeah, that would be like a game that comes out next year. Because it would be something.
It would just seem odd coming out after Mario Odyssey, you know, like you think of it more in that Wind Waker HD kind of slot, where it comes out, you know, so many months after the system hits the market, because it's holding you over to the bigger stuff, not after. But doesn't rule it out. But I guess the point is, though, if Mario 64 is more, you know, the kind of thing that would be more lucrative as a remake, does that mean therefore that, yeah, you know what, the best thing to do with Sunshine is just re-release it digitally in its original form, and then you back to how do you handle analog controller again?
All right, that hurt me a lot. Guillaume, would you read Soren's email?
Soren writes, with Nintendo shifting to a paid online service and an app-powered online lobby and chat, do you think we'll finally see Nintendo create online co-op experiences with their classic 2D franchises? I would love to play online co-op on 2D Mario, Yoshi, Kirby, and Donkey Kong series, but I don't know if Nintendo sees this as a priority, even when they'll be charging us for online play and their list of online titles is painfully small. Maybe Mario Party will finally get online play. Maybe it will get a return to Pikmin 2's classic multiplayer, but now online. I feel there are plenty of untapped opportunities, but I'm worried Nintendo doesn't see any of them. Thoughts?
Well, I will say that Pikmin's probably not going to get it because that game is already done, as they have told us about a year ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they would have had to have the foresight of charging for online, given that the game was finished so long ago.
For a system that they didn't quite finish developing the hardware for.
Yeah, I'm curious to see if they start doing this with VC games. In the ones that actually
we know they're going to do it on this one game a month basis for the VC games. I mean, it's just what games, you know, what kind do they go for, like a mix of games, like for instance, like the kind of the co-op games or the versus type games, you know, like presumably they won't be doing Street Fighter literally because there's a new Street Fighter too, bizarrely, but you know, things like that. Or the Contra style kind of co-op stuff. Super Mario Kart would be an interesting one, although that might be a bit more sort of significant change in that, you know. It's interesting because you've got two competing things here. On the one hand, they might be more willing to do this than before because the online might be seen as less of a sort of drain than it was before, because it's something that they're charging for. I mean, for instance, there's recent, just today, in Western territories, you had Tank Troopers come out, which, you know, is a very sort of multiplayer-focused game, but it has no online, even though that might seem like it would be something that would make it more, quite a bit more appealing. But presumably, you know, they don't feel it's worth allocating the resources to it. On a fairly small sort of budget game or something to make that possible. Now, maybe that sort of decision making, the calculus for that, could change a little bit if you're actually charging people for online, depending on, you know, how everything's used and, you know, who's paying for it and all that kind of stuff. Again, you know, some of this may be kind of contingent on the market realities as things play out. But the counter thing is, of course, that this system is so much about, like, you know, local multiplayer. It's so much about the fact that it's two players out of the box, you know, and that whole thing, you know, break off the controllers and play together and all that. You still kind of feel like that's going to be so much of their focus. I'm not that optimistic about this.
My counter argument, though, is that now that they're charging, now it's not just built into the box. They really, and here's the thing, Sony makes a tremendous amount of money on the online subscription. Microsoft makes a tremendous amount of their profit from the Xbox on just Xbox Live memberships.
Mm-hmm.
Nintendo needs to give you a reason why this is mandatory.
Why
you have got to pay this money. And Nintendo knows that the first group they need to get on board are their dyed-in-the-wool faithful. And how do you do that? You give them the quote Nintendo experiences where online is absolutely mandatory. You give them the experiences that have kept them buying fucking Wii U and say, like, hey, we're going to give you that experience now and it's online because we want you to pay for a subscription service. And the way you do that is you say, we're finally going to let you play Mario online with John Lindemann, and so you can scream at him over the internet about the fucking... Stop getting stuck in the goddamn bubble.
Never happened.
Like they're gonna have to finally cross that Rubicon because they need you to sign up for the online subscription.
The thing is, they have other vehicles for that sort of thing in terms of, you know, Splatoon is going to be huge, especially in Japan, in that sort of push. You know, for the online stuff, and you know, it may be the tricky part for them, I think, would be demonstrate, well, why is Splatoon on Switch as an online prospect so much better than it was on Wii U. Now they've got voice chat through the app thing, so that's something. But yeah, you know, making that value proposition seem attractive is kind of a problem they're going to have there. But it's worth mentioning, of course, we did get some indication of how much this might cost recently, right, coming out of the investor relations. Yeah, the sort of price band they're looking at least in yen terms, kind of maps out to sort of 20-some-odd bucks was a fairly straight convert, maybe 30, you know. But certainly it would seem on the, less than the services of Sony and Microsoft. So maybe they won't have to work as hard to justify it, but they've still got to do work on that. But,
yeah, really, I mean, to me, I could live without Splatoon. I could live without Mario Kart Online. I didn't play Mario Kart Online that much.
Yeah, I didn't either.
But if you told me that, hey, the next, you know, the next 2D Mario game is online, and I can play with you guys, it's like, all right.
Yeah, that's intriguing to me.
Yeah, like that's my games that are longer play games. You know, games that are like party games or like arena shooters or stuff that's played in short windows, like a fighting game. Going online and playing that, like that's sort of the normal appeal. But I can also get people to play those with me here, you know, because like I say, hey, I only need you for like an hour. My very utilitarian relationships with people, but things that are longer term plays, you know, things where I want somebody who's got a higher skill ceilings, things where I want to, you know, really get to experience a more complex or more not complex. Fighting games are really complicated, but a longer session. You know, I don't necessarily have somebody here who I could say, hey, let's play Mario for the next 3 hours.
No, I mean, I would say a good example of that actually would be if they did another Triforce Heroes / Four Swords Adventures type of game. I kind of feel like that would be, I mean, the big problem with Triforce Heroes for me was, I mean, I enjoyed the game in a number of respects, but region locked, which presumably would not be an issue with Switch, and the lack of voice chat, which again, you know, presumably would not be an issue with Switch. So if you revisited that concept, you know, as part of a push to say, you know, we're doing online, we're doing it well, and it's worth paying for, I could see that, because like you said, that's the kind of game that, yeah, I don't know whether it's not so easy to say, well, you could get someone locally to kind of play with you and stuff, because like you said, it's kind of more of a longer, an extensive experience. And there's there'd probably be a certain asymmetry in terms of who's more familiar with the Zelda puzzle language and all that kind of, you know, that's, I feel that works better as an online game, because you could, that enhances the potential to get, you know, similar players, you know, that complement each other well together to do it. The platformers is a bit less that way, because platforms generally tend to be simpler than that kind of experience, and maybe more bite-sized as well, just in terms of a few levels. But, I mean, you could have that, you know, something like Mario Maker. We've had emails in the past about that add-in kind of co-op stuff or whatever. A new Mario Maker that had, like, dedicated co-op level creation would be interesting, because online is such a big kind of component of that game in the first place. It's a kind of natural avenue to push another aspect of online interaction.
Right. One thing about Mario Maker, real quick. We talked about how a lot about that game, about the concern about, like, well, you can play this game without the touchpad being out. But JC of the Famicast somehow managed to get the Tomorrow Corporation to sort of spill the beans on using the gamepad's using the Switch touchscreen as a gameplay mechanic to draw stuff, and using the controller as sort of the analog. So.
Yeah, they could do pointing with World of Goo when it's docked to mimic the touchscreen capacity that they have not docked.
Famicasted journalism somehow.
But I mean, the interesting thing is that presumably that pointing functionality is like akin to the gyro pointing that the Nintendo brought in for Skyward Sword.
Yeah,
if you remember. With the gyro sensor in the Motion Plus, that actually did not use the sensor bar to do the pointing. It was just based on the motion detection.
What I would love to see, though, is let's say there's a Mario Maker game where I can make the level online. It would have to be online, because now there's not two screens. I would be making the level, and you could be doing stuff in it in real time, or I could be fucking
kind of make it together. Because to be fair, that's kind of, they kind of tried to push that a little bit locally with the 3DS one. The idea that it's like, yeah, you know, you and your friends kind of trade it back and forth and tinker with it. But yeah, if you take that online and then, you know, really kind of make it a more collaborative process, and have the voice chat there again.
Antagonistic too. Like,
there's always that.
I could drop shit in the stage while you're playing it.
But yeah, that is it's an interesting notion. I feel like Mario Maker has got a lot of legs in it. That the that framework, there's a lot of stuff they could do, and it's absolutely a natural kind of flagship for their online stuff. So I would certainly expect to see maybe that be the kind of thing that could deliver some of what Soren's looking for in terms of just like a new Super Mario Brothers game. Or a Kirby, another Kirby, in the lineage of, the 3DS ones that have come out, but now on Switch. That seems less likely, but I wouldn't rule it out. I think, again, it'll depend on how kind of, the feedback they get on how popular this kind of stuff is, and how much people use it and how much it drives them to pay for the online or whatever. Yeah, they'll have all their... their ways of getting feedback and data on this to see, and then if it's something that proves popular in certain sort of trial balloon kind of games, then maybe it'll get more implemented on a sort of broad basis. But I'd like to say, you've got to brace yourself for local co-op being a huge focus as well.
Sure.
Like I said, I don't think they shouldn't be at the exclusion of online.
No, but especially with now they're going to make
with Nintendo, it often seems to be. That's the problem.
I think now that it's a product they're trying to sell you, an add-on to the hardware, anytime they can put that blue dot, well, it was the blue dot on the Wii, I can't remember, it was the orange square on the Wii.
Yeah, the Nintendo Network logo with the
anytime little, they can put that logo on the box now, I think is crucial. Because they want essentially a one-to-one attach rate on that thing. They want, if you have a Switch, you have an online subscription. And that's how you do it. You make sure that you almost take the Microsoft approach during the original Xbox era, where every game had to have something. And it wasn't always the case, but it was 360. I'm sorry, but every game had to do something with the Xbox network. It didn't necessarily have to be online, but just it had to do a thing. And just say everything we make will have some component that uses the internet, because they want to make sure that your Switch is connected to Wi-Fi. And that you're aware that it's connected to Wi-Fi and that you're using it for that, because that's how you drive revenue. And that's how they drive more specifically online revenue, which is best for Nintendo, best for business, as it were. Anybody else?
I got nothing.
Great. All right. Yeah. Well, that will do it for email this week. You can send us your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Please put the Kutar as the subject line, because Kutar is anything and everything.
Kutar
is life. No matter where he is or what he is doing.
I guess it kind of simplifies things. If our listenership were Kutar, then either way, it's inflating.
That's right. Yep. All...
We don't have to sit, lying in bed at night, rolling around, wondering, oh God, how did people respond? They just inflated. We know that. We don't have to.
That's right. As long as they're inflating, we're fine. If we don't, if they listen to the show and don't inflate at all, we failed.
Yes, not provocative.
Speaking of provocative, I don't know. We are now 2 weeks out from Princess Tomato and the Salad Kingdom retroactive. I had to pause for a second to make sure I was going to say the right segment name.
Yep, you did.
So you can go post your comments and play along with us. It's not a very long game. I just, the guide I was looking at says it's about 5 to 6 hours. So come join us. It's an adventure game that was originally released on Japanese home computers about talking vegetables with a complex society. It's weird. But on that, Greg, what is our exit music this week?
Well, very appropriate of discussing Nintendo and online and all that. We had a request from Xander for the music that was featured in the Splatoon 2 trailer, which is called Incoming. But we haven't had any Splatoon music as the end music before.
Really?
Actually. So we've kind of... We're a bit sort of late to the party in one sense, but very much ahead of schedule in another here by having something from Splatoon 2. To be fair, it won't be long. End of March, the global test fire is coming. So that should be interesting. But yeah, Splatoon's music is a lot of fun. It certainly sounds like the sequel's going to be too. So I hope you'll enjoy this.
Yep. And enjoy this, because from here on out, it's all Kutar themes. And on that, I'm going to go inflate in the corner somewhere. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Later.
Bye.
So we've got to get Gion back on the call.
Oh, I didn't realize he was completely gone.
He dropped completely.
He's just fucking giving up on this episode.
Yep.
The MASB email is really long, and I cut it down. That's the one that had the audio play along with it. Which I know John hasn't read, which is good, because he's the star of it.
Oh, God.
While we are waiting for Guillaume to come back, I may as well just read it. It will be recorded, so he can do whatever the fuck he wants with it. I'm sure that won't get me in trouble. I toyed with doing voices, but it's called A Switchmas Carol. John is visited by three spirits. With the ghost of games past, we see a little John playing Master System while all the cool kids had an NES. Psycho Fox is just as good as Super Mario Brothers, guys. Really? Then comes the ghost of games present.
It was Zillion, by the way.
It was Zillion, okay. All my game systems are in the same room. But what's wrong with that one? If things don't change, I see an empty spot where a tiny Wii U once sat. Finally, the ghost of games future. Spirit, whose lonely grave is that? Why, it's yours, John Lindemann. Your backlog finally fell on you. No, no, Spirit, I'll change! John wakes up It's Friday morning. The Spirits did it all in one night. There's still time to pre-order a Switch. But digital download only for me from now on. That backlog won't get the best of me. Tiny Wii U. Feor bless us, everyone. Oh, what a merry Switchmas day. What the fuck is wrong with our audience?